Thanks, Nicholas. Okay, I'm going to talk about some joint work with Stan Molden at the University of North Texas. And first, let me say, if you've seen a version of this talk before, I'll partly apologize. And let me also say, this is sort of an expanded version of that, so I'll go into a little more detail in this talk. Dan also, I think, among other things in this talk, is going to mention go into a little more detail on some of the open problems associated with this, too. So probably in this talk, I'm going to focus a little bit more just on the construction of the set, the problem, and the sort of the solution to the original problem. So let me start with that. Okay, so the question was raised, as were many questions, by Steinhaus. And this question seems to go back to sometime around the late 50s. And the question was this. Let me say what the question was. The question was, does there exist a set in the plane that meets every isometric copy of the integer lattice in exactly one point? Okay, so in other words, from now on in this talk, when I say lattice, I'll just mean an isometric copy of the integer lattice. So the set must, anytime you move it or rotate it and put it anywhere you want in the plane, it's got to meet the set in exactly one point. Okay. Notice if you just said, if you removed rotations and you just said every translation of the integer lattice, notice it would be a trivial problem, right? Because you could essentially take the points in the unit square. So seemingly rotations is what makes the problem non-trivial. Let me just make that point because it'll be interesting eventually. We'll come back to that. Okay. Let's see. Let me mention some partial results. Erdős and Sierpinski independently showed that the result was true if instead of z cross z, you're allowed to replace that with your favorite set. Okay, in other words, you're allowed to find a set, set meaning not just containing one point. So I'll call that a non-trivial set with the property that there's a corresponding Steinhaus set, that is every isometric copy of A meets S in exactly one point. Okay, so, and then later, Komiat showed that result where instead of your favorite set, you can actually make it a little more like Z cross Z, that is, you can replace it by Z. So just think of that as just, just the points, the integer points. Okay, so anyway, so what we'd like to show in this talk is that how to construct a set that kind of that answers the question positively for Steinhaus's original question. So meet every lattice on exactly one point. Okay. All right. So, and then, of course, there's an interesting question, too, is given that the set exists, what kind of set can it be? And I think Dan will touch on that a little bit. I'll just mention very briefly, we've recently been able to show that the set can't have the bare property. Anyway, it's still open whether it can be Lebesgue measurable, but I think Dan will probably go into that in more detail. Okay, so let me kind of sketch how this sort of goes. The nice thing about giving this talk is that it doesn't use any sort of really advanced math. Anybody can really sort of understand it. I'm just going to use elementary things from a little bit of set theory, a little bit of number theory, a little bit of geometry. I think that's the interesting thing is that those three things sort of come into the mix in here. But I don't really use sort of really deep techniques from any of those three. Although non-trivial things, definitely, but just you don't need a lot of high-power machinery to understand what's going on. Let's start off by looking at some of these things related to this question and build up our set of techniques that we'll use to attack this problem. Okay, the first thing is let's reformulate the problem just a tiny bit so it looks something like more we can get a start on. So. There's a slight typo in here. Let me just correct this. So the problem is equivalent to saying that there is a set in the plane. Instead of saying it meets every lattice in exactly one point, if you think about it just for a second, that's easily equivalent to saying it does two things. It meets every lattice, okay, which I'll just call L. Once again, that means an isometric copy of Z cross E. And then just say for any two distinct points in the set, the distance between those points, let me just correct that. Just say it's not a lattice distance. So not the square root of n squared plus m squared, where n and m are integers. Okay, so that's easily the same. Okay, so your job is to build a set that meets every lattice, but the distance between any two distinct points in the set is not a lattice distance. Okay, we will actually show the stronger thing, that we will actually build a set that meets every lattice, and for any two distinct points in the set, the distance squared is not an integer. So that's, I'll come back to that in a second. What's that? Now we're going to build a set where any two distinct points, the distance squared is not even an integer. Not just saying it's not a lattice distance, but just saying it's not. No, it can't. It cannot even be the distance squared. For example, we're going to build a set where the distance between two points can't be the square root of 7, for example. Okay. Okay. It turns out a fairly small distinction, because the main obstacle, let me just say very quickly, since you brought it up, is we're doing this for rational one of the main things is doing this for rational translations of the integer lattice. And if you're just dealing with, and there the two are equivalent, because a point is a sum of, an integer is a sum of squares of two rationals, if and only it's a sum of squares of two integers. So for rational translations of the integer lattice, it's equivalent, but in general, it's not equivalent, so it's a slightly stronger statement. Okay, so let's see. What I want to try to do is motivate the proof first by showing you, I think a good thing is to show some of the two main obstructions to what happens if you just sort of naively attempt the construction. And then that leads to two lemmas that overcome the two obstructions. And armed with the two sort of lemmas, you can then sort of go back and do the construction. So let me sort of head towards that. And those two lemmas are the two main technical tools. We'll call lemma A and lemma B eventually here. Okay, so I should remark, what is the naive attempt? The naive attempt would be to say, okay, look, we're trying to build a set. We just got to meet every lattice. So we'll just enlarge the step. We'll enumerate all the lattices and step by step, at step alpha, try to meet the alpha lattice, and always maintain inductively the property that the distance squared is not an integer for any two points. That, of course, is preserved sort of trivially at limit stages. So you just got to make sure every time you add a new lattice, you meet it and just keep property 2. Okay. So let's call property 2, a set that satisfies property 2, a partial Steinhaus set. So if it's a partial Steinhaus set, it has a chance of being extended to a Steinhaus set. If it's not a partial Steinhaus set, then clearly it can't be extended to one. Okay. All right. So the first thing is that, and this is a big clue, is that finite obstructions exist in the rational, in Q cross Q. So here's an example. I'll show you how I got it a little bit later. So here's 17 points in Q cross Q, and you can check that these form a partial Steinhaus set. No distance squared of any two points there is an integer, which is equivalent because these are rational points. But anyway, so that's a partial Steinhaus set, but none of them have integer coordinates by inspection. But each one of these points, every point in Z cross Z lies at a lattice distance from one of those 17 points. So in other words, you cannot even extend that set to meet the integer lattice Z cross Z and keep it a partial Steinhaus set. Okay, so that shows you there's a danger out there. You can't just naively do the construction. And moreover, it points to what probably you're going to need to do. You're going to have to deal with the case rational cross rational. That is, you're going to have to deal with all the rational translations of Z cross Z by some sort of separate lemma. You're going to need a magic lemma that says we can do the rational translations of Z cross Z. Okay, that is, this will have to be sort of outside the main induction. Okay, so otherwise you might hit such an obstruction along the way, and you need some reason to guarantee you're not going to do that. All right. Actually, let me keep that up there and go over here. Okay, now one thing is, if you with that trivial translation of the problem, just saying we're trying to build a partial Steinhaus set to meet all the lattices, it now makes sense to actually restrict the problem to a smaller set of lattices too. For example, let's just take the rational translations of Z cross Z. So just take all the lattices Z cross Z, just move them by rational translations. Okay, now it's no longer trivial. Remember, I said it was trivial at the beginning if you threw away rotations, just consider translations. Now the problem is not trivial anymore. To do it even just for, in fact, just for the rational translations even, it's not trivial anymore. Because, of course, you know, you can't just take the points in unit square. Of course, there are points that are integer distance, 0, 0, and 3 fifths, 4 fifths, right, of course. So, and you are going to eventually have to, if you're going to enlarge this to a Steinhaus set, keep things not at a lattice distance. So viewed this way, the problem is non-trivial even for just translations and even for just rational translations. Okay. All right. So as I said, that's really what we're going to show is the stronger thing, where the distance squared is not an integer. Okay, so that naive attempt to prove the theorem by sort of doing things inductively is indeed sort of what you want to do, but there's sort of two things you need to sort of to make it work. Okay, let me sort of show those. Okay, first of all, you're going to have to use some sort of notion of an elementary substructure or a hull. OK, Okay, this is an idea that's occurred in several proofs along these lines, and it's very familiar, very basic, familiar concept to set theorists, maybe not so well known to other people. But anyway, so at each step, instead of considering just one lattice, you're going to consider a bunch of lattices, namely the lattices in some substructure or some hull. So in other words, close under enough operations that are of interest. We'll see exactly in a little bit what those operations have to be. But all right, so in other words, at each step, for example, if you had the continuum hypothesis, you would enumerate the lattices into omega 1 steps. So at each step, instead of one lattice, you'd have a countable family of lattices closed under enough operations. Okay. All right, let's see. So I already mentioned you're going to need some lemma that allows you to handle the Q cross Q case. Those are the finite obstructions. And then you're going to have to, at limit stages, it should still be trivial, but you're going to have to do the general successor step, which I'll sort of come back to in just a second here. We'll see how we sort of start to attack the successor step. Okay, see why that suggests the whole argument. Let me motivate why you need a whole argument in addition to this other magic lemma on Q cross Q. All right, so let's assume you're building an increasing sequence of holes here. Okay. So once again, if you want to, if you're a non-set theorist, you can just think of that as each M alpha is a family of lattices closed under enough operations. And let's assume we're inductively building these sets, S alpha, along the way, which are partial Steinhaus sets. We're always going to keep that. And let's assume at step alpha, S meets all the lattices in M alpha, that's the obvious requirement as we're trying to build this. Okay. Okay. All right, so let's say we're proceeding inductively like that. Now let's say we're at a successor step. And we've got a new lattice. Let's call it L. Okay. Okay, one sort of simple point is that there can be at most one point in the set that you've already constructed, let's call it S alpha, which has rational coordinates with respect to a lattice. Okay. I think that should be clear what I mean. When I say a lattice, it has its own coordinate system. When I say, a rational translation, or rational with respect to that coordinate system, it means with respect to the unit basis vectors of that lattice. Okay, so the claim is there can be at most one whole point that has rational coordinates with respect to that lattice. That's easy to see because if there were two, you could easily see that lattice was definable from those two points and hence would be in that substructure, M alpha. Okay. In fact, there's a quick little proof of that. I think I'll just skip that. It's just a little linear algebra shows that. Okay. Okay, now, all right, so if you look back in that set, you can see at most one point that has rational coordinates with respect to that lattice. So let's for the moment ignore that point. Okay, we'll have to eventually come back to it, but let's sort of ignore it for the moment. Okay, so essentially all the points that you've already got in S alpha have irrational or non-rational coordinates with respect to this new lattice. Okay, I'll call that point an exceptional point, the one that possibly may have rational coordinates. Okay, so let's just assume that doesn't exist, just to simplify things for a second. Assume all points of S alpha don't have rational coordinates. All right, so now we're going to try to extend our set to meet this new lattice L, which is in the family M alpha plus 1, the next lattice in the next hull. All right. So here's the argument we'd like to give. We'd like to say, okay, let's just start off randomly taking a point in that new lattice and attempt to add it and see what happens. Okay, well, if we can't add it, that means there's a point in the set that we've already got. Let's call it C1, so that the distance squared, so that it would be at a lattice distance from this new point. In particular, the distance squared would be an integer. In particular, the distance squared would be a rational. For the moment, that's all I need. So So there would be some point certainly in S alpha where the distance squared is irrational. Okay, let's call that point C1 to think of it as generating the center of a circle. So let's let C1 in fact be that circle with center at C1 and radius this lattice distance out to the point. Here's the new lattice L. Here's the point Z1 we're attempting to add. And here's a point C1 that's in the old set, and this distance here, R1, is this lattice distance. So think of that as forming a circle. Okay, now here's a lemma that's not too hard to show, which will tell us what to do in a second. We'll come back to our strategy. So the first point, Z1, we cannot add because it's at a bad distance. Now here's a simple little computation. Okay, I claim the following little geometry fact, which just takes a line or two to show. Suppose you take any lattice, suppose you have any point C and R2, like that C1 for example, and suppose C has coordinates with respect to that lattice that are not both rational. Okay, and that's what I'm assuming. I'm assuming that point C1 is not that exceptional point. Okay, then I claim that there's a line, which I'll call L, which depends on Z, and which you think of as a function of Z and L, such that if you take any point that has rational coordinates with respect to L, and it's not on that line, then the distance squared cannot be irrational. In other words, what I'm saying over here is that there is a line L, so that any other point, in fact, not just on this lattice, but in fact any other point that has rational coordinates with respect to this lattice, if it's going to be bad for this point, that is, if this distance squared is going to be rational, then the point must lie on this line. So in other words, the Z1 has this old point that, so this is a lattice distance. There are probably other points on this lattice that this point rules out, but they only form a line. So if I go off this line and try to put another point on the lattice, this point, C1, will not rule it out. It will not be at a lattice distance. Okay, so every old point can only rule out a line. Okay, and this is, once again, I think I'll just skip it, but you can see it's kind of a short little proof. It's basically, if you just had, if you had three points, that the center point XY ruled out, if you just see what it means to say the distance squared is an integer, I mean, sorry, a rational, there's the equation right there. And if you just take the three equations and just subtract them in pairs, the quadratic terms will cancel, and you'll just get two linear equations in X and Y right here. And then if that's a non-singular system, then you could solve for X and Y, and they would both be rational. That would be the contradiction. So it must be a singular system, so the three points must lie on a line. Okay. All right, anyway, so an easy argument shows that. Okay. Okay, so let's call that line L1. So that's the line that the point C1 rules out. Okay. Okay, so now we come off and we try to add another point. So obviously we pick a point not on this line, because we don't want this point to rule it out. So we'll pick a point Z2 that's not on that line. And the problem is there might be a point C2, also in S alpha, where this distance is also a lattice distance. We'll call it R2. And thereby consider the big circle, big C2. Okay. All right, so that's all I'm doing here. And notice that C2 is a distinct point from C1 because we picked Z2 to not be on that line. Okay. Okay. And now we go one more step. Let's try to add a third point. So let's take Z3. And let's suppose it goes bad. So there's likewise some center C3 and S alpha, and this is a lattice distance, or the distance squared is rational. That's all I really need here. And that forms the third circle C3. Okay. Now the claim is it stops there with three circles. Let's see why it stops there, or why we think it stops there. Okay. If you take and this is why you need the Hull argument. So this is the motivation for why we need to consider Hulls instead of just the straightforward enumeration of equivalence classes. If we look at these three circles that we defined, they all lie in the old model, so to speak. That is, they lie in M alpha, the previous level Hull. That's because these three center points we said were in S alpha, which is in M alpha, and these radii are certainly all definable. They're just square roots of rational numbers. So these three circles all lie in sort of the model M alpha, if you want to put it in those terms. Okay. Also, if you look at these three points, Z1, Z2, and Z3, which lie on these three circles respectively, those points do not lie in the model a priori, but if you look at the triangle that they form, the congruence class of that triangle certainly lies in the old model as well, because, after all, these are just three. This triangle is just the congruence class of a triangle just sitting on the integer lattice, so certainly that's definable. The congruence class of the triangle is certainly definable. So in other words, we're in the situation we have three circles that are in a model M alpha, and we have a congruence class of a triangle which lies in that model, and that triangle has the property that the three vertices just lie on these three circles. Okay, but now what we'd like to say, now you see the point, what we'd like to say is that there's only finitely many arrangements of this triangle. That is, if you take this triangle, think of it as a rigid triangle, we're just looking at its congruence class. There's only finitely many ways you can take this triangle and put it so that the three vertices lie on these three circles. That's what we'd like to say. If that's the case, then these three points are in fact definable from these objects which lie in M alpha. And that's a contradiction then, because these three points, and hence the lattice which is definable from these three points, would have lied in M alpha instead of, and supposedly it was a new lattice in L alpha, in M alpha plus 1 minus M alpha. Okay, so let me take that and just reword that a little bit, what I just said, to put it in sort of more classical terminology. Okay, so let me draw another picture over here. Instead of three circles, let's just look at the two of the circles, C1 and C2. And let me just redraw the picture. So here's C1 and here's C2. Okay. And let me just focus on the two points, Z1 and Z2, which lie on these two circles. And somewhere off there, here's the third point, where this is a rigid triangle. So what we're really saying, so to show that this, there's only finitely many arrangements, another way to say that is, if you constrain Z1 and Z2 to be on these two circles and sort of move the triangle subject to that constraint, then the locus of points traced out by Z3 has to intersect any circle in a finite set. That's what we're trying to say here. So that's what we want to say here. So if you have two circles and you have two points that are constrained to lie on those two circles, you have a rigid bar connecting them, then as it moves around, the locus of points traced out by a third point on the triangle cannot be any part of a circle, cannot have a circular component. Okay. It's a piecewise analytic curve, and it's enough to say it just does not have a quadratic component. Okay. Now, this is actually, it turns out, a very well-studied problem. The basic mechanism that we have here, two circles and a rigid bar attached to the two points in two circles, is what's called a four-bar linkage or a three-bar linkage, depending on the terminology. That is, you can kind of think of it as, saying these lie on the circles, you can kind of think of it as these two points are fixed, and just think of it as a bar connecting this point and this point, and a bar connecting this point and this point, and these are just on a hinge. These are just hinges. And so you just have sort of these three bars, or sometimes it's called a four bar because you could think of a fourth bar as being right here. Anyway, so just sort of three or four bars that are hinged together, and then this rigid triangle attached to this one bar. Okay. All right, sometimes that's called a coupler point. Okay. So in other words, what we're really asking then is the locus of points traced out by the coupler point in a four-bar linkage, can that ever have a circular component? Okay. Now once again, this is the theory of mechanical linkages has a very rich history, and lots of effort went into it over the years asking this question. It was something we had to. The literature seems to be a little bit sort of some of it's done by mathematicians, some of it's done by engineers, and it's sort of a little bit of. Anyway, sometimes it's hard to find things out here. So one quick comment here. So what we'd like to prove is this lemma. Now, let's see. There's one immediate exception to this lemma that comes up. That is what I just said is false easily. In this generality for any two circles. Namely, there's the case, which they call the parallelogram case in this theory, mechanical linkages. We just call it the wheels of on a train here. Namely, if you have two circles that are exactly the same size, and you have a bar, the rigid bar, the distance, the length of this rigid bar is exactly the distance between these two centers, then these would just move around sort of in complete sort of harmony, so to speak, and this third point would likewise then just trace out a circle of the exact same size. So that's a clear counterexample to the. To what we'd like is that this thing never traces out, it never has a quadratic component. However, notice one bit of optimism here. In this exceptional case to what we'd like to be true, this is our Z1 and Z2 point. In that case, the distance between Z1 and Z2 is the same as the distance between C1 and C2. So these lie on a lattice, so these are at a lattice distance. So that would say C1 and Z2 are at a lattice distance, and that's a contradiction because they're coming from the set that we've already constructed, S alpha, which by induction, no two distinct points are at a lattice distance. So in other words, this exception to what would like to be true it does not occur in this inductive construction, or the thing that we're sketching at least. It seems like it may have the chance of not occurring. So based on what I just showed you there, it looks like if that's the only case of degeneracy in that attempted theorem on the four-bar linkage, then we might have a chance. Okay. That's okay. So that's all I want to say for now. Okay, so now let me say exactly what the two lemmas are that we need. Okay, so that shows you that you are going to need some sort of hull construction, right? I mean, in here, we are using the fact that this, you know, there's finitely many things. If this lemma is true, there's going to be finitely many arrangements of this triangle, so they're definable from those circles and hence in the model. So that's clearly, you need some sort of assumption then that you're dealing with some sort of a hull rather than just a straightforward induction. Okay. Okay, so now I think that I've done enough motivation where I can actually state the two things that you need. So it's two lemmas, as I promised you, a lemma A and a lemma B. So lemma A is the magical lemma that's going to handle the rational translations of Z cross Z. Okay, so I haven't given you a clue as to why it's true yet, but let me just state it officially at least. So it says, look at all the rational translations of Z cross Z. So just no rotations now, just rational translations. Then I want to say there is a set which is a partial Steinhaus set, namely the distance squared for any distinct points is not an integer, and it meets every such lattice. So in other words, all I'm just saying is you can get a partial Steinhaus set meeting all the rational translations of the integer lattice. Okay. All right, now I'll sketch a little bit why that's true in a minute. But this is sort of a pure number theoretic lemma. All right. And then finally, here's what I just said, the geometry lemma. So now the claim is that is indeed the only exception to this purported theorem on the four-bar linkage. So if you take any three distinct points in the plane, which we think of as centers of circles, take any three positive numbers which you think of as radii of the circles, we'll call the circle C1, C2, and C3. And suppose somebody hands you a triangle, which we'll think of the vertices as being three points, Z1, Z2, and Z3. Then, except for that exceptional case, there's only finitely many congruent classes, finitely many arrangements of that triangle, P1, P2, and P3, where P1 is on the first circle, P2 is on the second circle, and P3 is on the third circle. And the exceptional case is the one I just mentioned right over there. Okay. So, like I said, the history of this, it took us a while, and with some very helpful references from some of the referees of our paper, we were finally able to locate, let's see, so it turns out this was sort of more or less known. I mean, we still couldn't find it explicitly in the literature, but there was a paper, I think it's an 86 paper of Gibson and Newstead, some algebraic geometers, where they proved something. It's not actually stated in the paper, but when we communicated this question to them, asked them, they were able to say, yeah, it follows from the arguments in this paper. So in that sense, the result is known. We also gave an elementary direct proof of it. But anyway, so the proof that they gave is actually far from elementary. You have to quote various facts about genuses of curves and things. Let me just say very quickly, what we actually need is a slight technical strengthening of this lemma. It's hardly worth stating in a general talk, but let me just... what we really say is, what we really need is, not only can we get a partial Steinhaus set meeting every rational translation of the integer lattice, but we want to be able to say that we can do it in a fairly free way. We still have a lot of freedom in the construction. So more precisely, if you have any set that we call small, then you can actually build a set to avoid a small set. Okay, what does small mean? Small means on every copy of Z cross Z contained in every rational translation, the set will meet that lattice in a set which is contained in finitely many lines. Okay, so think of that as being some kind of notion of smallness. So we, such a small set can be missed in the construction if you so desire. Okay. Okay. All right. So now, I've now told you the two lemmas that you need, A, or actually more precisely A prime and B. So for the moment, if you'll allow me, just accept those two lemmas, the number theory lemma and the geometry lemma. And let me just sort of, given those two precise statements, let me sort of actually go back and sketch now how you actually build the set. How we actually do it, given those two lemmas. Okay, so I gave you a very rough idea here, but let me try to make it a little more precise. All right, so here's an interesting point. Remember the original version of the problem, Steinhaus's problem, was trivial. We said if you don't allow rotations, just translations. Okay. Then we said if you viewed it a slightly different way of just building the set must be a partial Steinhaus set that you build. Then we said it wasn't trivial. Even if you just consider translations, it wasn't trivial. Now we're going to go one step further, and I'm going to say viewed this way, we can eliminate rotations completely. Rotations are now out of the picture. That is, we only need to worry about translations when we build a set. Now let me explain this point. Okay. But that's going to be a key point. So actually, when we do this, we never actually worry about rotations at all. All right. So let's say two lattices are equivalent. Let's say L and L prime, two isometric copies of Z cross Z, are equivalent. If you can get one lattice from the other by rational movements, that is translations and rotations that are rational in the coordinate system of one of the lattices. Okay. If you think about this a second, this is equivalent to saying every point in one lattice has rational coordinates with respect to the other and vice versa. So they each have rational coordinates with respect to the other. Okay. All right. So that's a natural equivalence relation on the family of lattices. And here's the lemma which I just said essentially says we do away completely with rotations. It says, Suppose you have a lattice. Fix a lattice for a moment somewhere out in the plane. Suppose you have a set which is a partial Steinhaus set, that is property 2 is satisfied. Okay, and suppose it meets every lattice which is a rational translation of that lattice. Okay, just translation, no rotation, just meets the rational translations of that lattice. Then the claim is it automatically meets every lattice equivalent to that lattice. So not just translations, but rational rotations as well. So if you pick a representative from each equivalence class, if you just meet the translations of that the rational translations of that lattice, then you automatically meet all the lattices in the equivalence class, assuming you're number 2, or assuming you're a partial Steinhaus set. Okay. So that really refines our strategy now. Now we're going to enumerate. So we're going to take this increasing sequence of hulls, more or less, And each step, we're going to look at the new equivalence classes that we get. Let's think of representatives being fixed from those equivalence classes. Then our job is just to, keeping a partial Steinhaus set, meet the rational translations of each of those representatives from the equivalence classes. Okay. Let's see. Since I have a little time here, let me just go off and give you kind of a very brief, just for the sake of amusement, a very brief sketch of why that's true. Because it may seem mysterious at first. I mean, after all, why is it true that if you meet the translations, you automatically meet the rotations? Okay, here's a very brief sketch of that for amusement here. So, here's a lattice. Let me just sort of designate that as the origin. Okay. And let's assume we have a partial Steinhaus set, that is property 2 is satisfied, and it meets all the rational translations of this lattice. Now I want to argue that it meets every equivalent lattice, so I can do a rational rotation and or translation of this thing. Okay. So I could express that by doing the following. Here's a rational rotation of it. That means the matrix giving the rotation consists of rational numbers. And then to a rational rotation, not possibly a rational translation of this thing in its coordinate system. All right. So let me introduce some notation here. Okay, so for example, I might call this point right here A over D, B over D, minus B over D, A over D. Okay. So there's the rotation. Now I'm going to do a rational translation and argue that the partial Steinhaus set must meet it. Okay. I'm doing this for any rational translation of this thing. There's no harm in assuming that my denominator in my rational translation is a multiple of D. I can always just make it that. So take some, let D divide E. And let's consider a rational translation in the coordinate system of this lattice by a certain amount, you know, A over E, B over E. So in other words, this one right here, this lattice. And let's attempt to argue our set must meet it, and then we're done, right? That would be the general case. So the way you do this, so here's the trick. The trick is we'll show it meets all of them simultaneously, all these E squared lattices whose origins are one of these points, A over E, B over E, where A, B are between 0 and E. Okay, there's E squared such points, obviously. We're going to show it meets them all simultaneously. Okay, so the way you do that, here's a little trick. It's just sort of amusing. You say, look at the lattice that you get consisting of all points just extending this grid. So the scale dimension here would be 1 over E. So just kind of continue this on. Okay, so now here's the fact. Obviously, there's E squared many points in this unit square in the rotated lattice. The claim is there's also exactly E squared many points of this lattice in the original unit square. Okay, this is kind of a basic fact about lattices, I'll skip it, but it's very easy to show. So there's exactly E squared points in this lattice in this unit square as well. Okay. In the coordinate system of the original Z cross Z, they no longer have denominators E, right? Because the denominators would be most D times E, because you've done a rotation with the matrix involving D, and these points have coordinates E in the system. Anyway, so they no longer, you can't make that claim anymore that they have denominators just E, but they're still rational points, and there's E squared many of them in this lattice. Okay, now here's what you argue. You say, look, my Steinhaus set was assumed to meet all the rational translations of this lattice. So for all these E squared points, I can move it some integer pair of distance and put it in the Steinhaus set. Okay? If I take these E squared points and I move them by integer distances till there's integers on each coordinate till they're in the Steinhaus set, trivially, no two of those points will go to the same point because these are in the fundamental domain of the ordinary lattice. So they're clearly, and you're moving them by integer, so clearly they're going to go to distinct points. So you'll get E squared points up here in your Steinhaus set. Okay, now take those E squared points and move them, okay, and also one other, these E squared points, if you look back in the rotated lattice, what kind of coordinates do they have? Well, these had denominators no worse than E in the rotated coordinate system. Now you're moving them by integers, which in the rotated system would mean denominators D. So things with denominator E and you're adding things with denominator D, and D divides E. So in the rotated coordinate system, these still have denominators no worse than E. Okay. So now move them back in the rotated coordinate system back into the fundamental domain in the rotated system. Okay, here's the key point. These E squared points still move to distinct points in the rotated system. Because if two of them move to the same point, then that would say in the rotated system they differ by integer coordinates. But that would make the distance squared still an integer. It doesn't matter whether that's the rotated lattice or the standard lattice. That would still be the case. And since this is a partial Steinhaus set, that's not allowed. So therefore, when you take these E squared points and move them back into this lattice, they're all distinct. And they all have denominators E, no worse than E. So therefore, they must cover these E squared points exactly, and therefore every point is hit. That's the proof. Okay. All right, so that's a simple little lemma, but it's very important because it says now we don't have to worry about rotations in doing the construction. All right. Let me just very quickly say one point here. I'm not going to go through quite all this. Let me just say, so with those two lemmas we're trying to do our hull construction, there's one sort of point you have to be a little bit careful of. If the continuum if CH held, it would be enough just to sort of, I mean, you would just enumerate these equivalence classes that are these hulls of type omega 1, and then just sort of do the construction. If the continuum is bigger than omega 1, you have to be a little bit careful how you do this. It's not enough just to proceed sort of inductively. You run into a slight problem. So you have to work with these sort of weaker hulls in this case. So let me just quickly just draw a picture here. I think that's probably better than putting that slide up. So if you remember that obstruction I showed you in the beginning, the 17 points that could not be extended to a full Steinhaus set, that comes back to haunt you if you try to do the hull construction using real hulls. If the continuum were Aleph 17, it turns out then you'd have to prove a version of lemma A where you're allowed to start with an arbitrary partial Steinhaus set consisting of 17 points, it turns out. And that we know can fail. So you will run into a problem at some point if you don't kind of work with a somewhat weaker notion of hull. So what you really do, it's not a big deal, but what you really do is, let's say the continuum is Aleph 2, for example. It's important that you actually do it this way. So first break up all the lattices or whatever into an omega 2 increasing sequence of hulls. Let's just say we're worried about the lattices in each substructure here, so there's omega 2 of them all together. So here's, let's say, M alpha. Here's M alpha plus 1. So for each alpha, what you like to do then, or what you need to do then, is take the difference of these two hulls. Let's call that N alpha. And write it, and that would be an object of size omega 1 many equivalence classes, and write that as an increasing sequence of, now you can't say they're hulls anymore, but you say they're sort of weak hulls. They're sort of relatively closed inside this difference under the Skolem functions. They're not closed outright because the difference is not a substructure, but they're relatively closed. Okay. Anyway, so it's important that you have to work with that slightly weaker notion. It turns out that's good enough. So what I'd like to say then is that, so if you take these three ingredients, you take the hull construction, we're working with these slightly weaker hulls, you take lemma A and you take lemma B, the claim is from those three ingredients you can now give the inductive construction that you wanted to give right in the beginning. Okay, so let me just say, a word or two, a little more detail about that, and then I'll come and make some comments about the two lemmas. Okay, so indeed, the inductive hypothesis is what we just said. So notice here, when I take this N alpha and I break it up, I would call these partial hulls here M alpha 1 alpha 2. So in general, just for general value of the continuum, these are going to be indexed by some finite sequences of ordinals that coming from some tree. So the general weak hull would be denoted M sub alpha vector. Okay, so the idea then is by induction on the index there, on the alpha vector, try to build a Steinhaus set to meet all the lattices in M sub alpha vector. Okay, properties 1 through 4 here just say that's what you want to do. So it's going to be increasing. You're going to, at step beta, you're going to meet all the ordinals in every lattice in M beta. I forgot to say. So this construction of these models stops whenever there's only countably many lattices in the difference here. So typically these will have size omega 1. So if the continuum were Aleph 2, so then typically these differences at this level would have size omega. So if the continuum were Aleph 2, this would just stop in two steps. But in general, you keep going until there's only countably many lattices going to the next step. Okay. At that point, you could then enumerate them. So, for example, if the continuum were Aleph 2, we would call the lattices L sub alpha 1, alpha 2, n. So that would enumerate all the lattices, the countably many lattices in m or n alpha 1 alpha 2. All right. Okay, so 1 through 4 says you're just going to do that, and then there's actually a small technical thing that you need to keep the induction alive. That's property 5 there. It just says, even though you're only trying to build a set where the distance squared is not an integer, you need a technical hypothesis about when the distance squared can be rational. So the technical hypothesis just says, along the way you're going to arrange so that the distance squared between any two distinct points in the set you're building is rational even. You're not going to say that never happens. Of course, that's going to happen, because they could come from the same lattice. But you're going to say, when that happens, then the only way that could happen is if both points had rational coordinates with respect to some lattice along the way. Okay, so that's the only way that could happen. All right, and we'll try to maintain that technical hypothesis along the way. Okay, so let me just say the construction goes pretty smoothly armed with those three lemmas. So what you want to do is a diagonal argument. Let me just say what the diagonal argument is and then what the one key claim is, and that'll be all I'll say for this. Skip to the slide here. So at the alpha stage, you've enumerated these countably many new equivalence classes, or whatever. Say this is a representative from the nth equivalence class. So at this stage, you'll have countably many lattices. I'll now just simplify the notation and call them L1, L2, L3. Okay, and pick representatives from these classes. So now your job is to meet the rational translations of all these countably many lattices. So what you're going to do is you're going to do that in omega many stages, kind of diagonalizing. So you'll meet some lattices here, then some here, then back here, etc. Okay. And the reason it needs to be kind of a diagonal argument is because at each step, when we add some points, or when we try to meet some new lattices in Ln, okay, we have to make sure that if a point that's already been constructed does not have rational coordinates with respect to this lattice, then we need to know we're not on the exceptional line for that point, according to that previous lemma that I showed you. And so we need to know that there's only finitely many such lines so that we can still have plenty of room to go off and add a point. So that's why you started at each point, at each step, you want to eventually cover all of these, but each step you want to make sure you only have finitely many points that you've actually added, finitely many lattices that you've actually had to worry about. Okay, so that gives you fix a bijection between pairs and integers there, and then you just sort of do this back and forth, or this diagonal argument here. The claim is then armed with lemmas A and B, you can do that omega length construction. The only thing that you have to worry about, the only thing that might go bad, but this is an important point. Given lemmas A and B, the only thing that can go wrong is sort of the worry is summarized in this key claim here. When it comes time to consider a new lattice Ln, so here's the new lattice. Let's say we're at the stage in the diagonal argument where we haven't added any points to this lattice yet. Now it's time to add some points to this lattice, okay, according to our lemma A algorithm. Okay, now we've already added a lot of points in these, perhaps, to these earlier lattices. Okay, we've kept it a partial Steinhaus set by induction, but we've added a bunch of points. Now these lattices are not disjoint. Okay, they come from different equivalence classes, and different equivalence classes, if you think about it, any two lattices from distinct equivalence classes can meet at most one point. So they're sort of weakly disjoint, but they're not literally disjoint. And the problem might be that in adding the points to all these earlier lattices, even though it's a partial Steinhaus set, maybe you've inadvertently already added a lot of points having rational coordinates on this lattice. For example, suppose you've added 17 of them. And then maybe it forms that obstruction that we saw earlier. And so you'd still have a problem in that case. All right. But the key claim is, armed with that technical hypothesis, that number 5 we had up earlier, you can prove this key claim that when at step n, when you're considering this new lattice here, there can be at most one point from all the earlier lattices, from the points you've added to the earlier lattices, together with the set that you've already constructed, I'll call S less than alpha vector, which has rational coordinates. So at most one point accidentally sneaks on this lattice. Okay. Given that, that's no problem. You can always live with one point. If somebody forces a point on you, you can, that's okay. You can just center your construction right at that point, make that the origin, and just do it. How many points could you live with if you had to? I'm not sure. 17 you can't live with. 1 you can live with. I'm not sure exactly what the minimum size obstruction, what the minimum size partial Steinhaus that is, it can't be extended. That's a good question, good combinatorial question. But anyway, you don't have to worry about it because the key claim says, having done the construction with that technical hypothesis, there's at most one such point, and you can live with that. Okay. All right, let me just make a few comments about the number theory and the geometry. So I've described kind of the set theory that went into it, this sort of hull construction, using these sort of weak hulls, and that works given the two lemmas. Let's see. So the geometry lemma I'm going to probably say less about. Let me just say very quickly. First two comments. In Komiat's argument from 92, where he showed for the Z case, he proved kind of, it's kind of interesting. He actually proved a weaker version of lemma, this lemma B, this geometry lemma. Even though the full lemma, like I said, in some sense theoretically was known. So in a nutshell, what he proved was the version of it where, well, first of all, instead of three circles, you just say a finite number, S. Okay, so just say there's some finite number of circles, S. And then you require that these points, Z1 through ZS, I put no requirement on them, but in this weaker version, require them to be collinear. So just say there's only finitely many arrangements of these collinear points which lie on these circles. So that's clearly weaker for those two reasons. But it's much easier to prove in that case. Okay, so the fact is, if you want to work harder, you can in fact get by with that easier geometry lemma here too. But in some sense, I think it's interesting. I think our feeling is that the connection with mechanical linkages is actually quite interesting. And as we go to higher dimensions, I think that I think that's a good insight into the problem. So it may be that ultimately you can simplify the geometry, but anyway, you lose some of the geometrical insight, I think. Okay. You might ask yourself, can you prove that lemma just on the computer? I mean, can you just pull out Maple and feed in those curves and just tell it to directly show that's not a circle? And the answer is sort of yes. This turns out to be something that was known too, that there is a very nice way to parameterize the problem. It turns out if you don't use the nice parameterization, it's hopeless even on the computer. But if you parameterize it correctly, then the computer can do it. And I forgot the name for this parameterization, but it's a well-known thing. And it turns out the way to parameterize it is you parameterize it in terms of the angle that this bar, this rigid bar makes with the horizontal. Call that theta. So you fix this point x, y, and then you parameterize it in terms of that angle. And if you do that, although it becomes still rather messy, the computer can actually do it in that case. So it's just a very simple thing, but just sort of amusing. Here's the relevant equation that come out. If you parameterize those angles and plug it back in, this solves for the point x, y on the which I'm calling z1 over there, and you get these two equations for x and y. Then you have to put those back into the equation of the unit circle, x squared plus y squared equals 1. You can imagine that's going to be a very, very huge equation. I didn't print it out here, but it gives you a messy equation. But from that, then you can have, the computer can handle it easily and show that the theorem is true at that point. So let me, that's all I want to say on that. Let me just, perhaps the most interesting thing is even though this is a set theory, perhaps the most interesting the problem is actually the number theory, which is that thing I call the lemma A. What we actually showed is a stronger result. For lemma A, I said that there's a partial Steinhaus set meeting every rational translation of the of Z cross Z. What we can actually show as a stronger result is that if you take sort of any partial Steinhaus set that meets all the rational translations for a fixed denominator. For example, let's take D equals 5. Take the prime 5. There's 25 lattices then with that denominator. Okay, so let's say you have a partial Steinhaus set that meets those 25 lattices. Then the claim is if you take any larger, or take any D prime or D divided D prime, then you can extend the partial Steinhaus set up to meet those lattices. So for example, let's say you had a partial Steinhaus set meeting those 25 lattices and you moved up from 5 to, let's say, 5 times 13, 65 squared lattices. The theorem would say you can actually extend the partial Steinhaus set to meet those lattices. So it's kind of interesting because you can't extend a general one. You can't do the extension problem in general, as I pointed out in the beginning. But it says if you have one that meets all these d squared many lattices, then you can extend it up to a bigger integer. Okay. So, and also one little extra interesting bit of information here is that amusing number theoretic fact is that for primes it does turn out to be true. So that is, any partial Steinhaus set where the denominators are prime can be extended up to a full Steinhaus set. So if you gave me a partial Steinhaus set meeting some subset of those 25 lattices, I could extend it up to meet all the 25 lattices. So the only finite obstructions occur for things that are not prime. So in that example of the 17 points I showed you, all the denominators were 65. So 5 times 13. Okay. And lastly, in the number theory part here, okay, let me show you one thing. So in the proof, we actually have an algorithm for doing this. So for example, it's sort of amusing. You can do this on the computer. For example, here's building the partial Steinhaus set for denominator 5, d equals 5. So there's 25 lattices there. The two functions k and l I'm describing are the x and y translations, the integer translations you have to meet, and that's the point you throw in the Steinhaus set. So I'm describing the 25 points that are going into the partial Steinhaus set. So like I said, this one could then be extended up to 5 times 13, and then whatever. The reason I'm picking the primes 5 and 13 is because it turns out for primes congruent to 1 mod 4, everything's trivial. That is, if you had a partial Steinhaus set and you want to enlarge it by a prime congruent to 1 mod 4, it turns out if you just work out the number theory, it's fairly trivial. It's only the primes congruent to 3 mod 4 that are non-trivial, which make the problem hard. So going from like 5 to 65 is sort of where the number theory is, the real number theory is. Okay. So anyway, that's a little feeling for how we do this. The technical notion that comes up in the proof of the number theory is this thing called a good permutation. It's a purely algebraic fact. You find a certain type of permutation of length d, which we call good, and the problem is then kind of reduced down to a number theory problem so that you can extend sort of good permutations of length d up to good permutations of length d prime or d divided d prime, and then you sort of prove that. That's oversimplifying a little bit, but that's kind of the basic thing that's going on here. So here I started with this sort of the identity permutation just to get started. And our algorithm from the identity permutation generated this set of 25 numbers. Okay, so that's all. Thanks.